Hi folks, welcome to this fairly impromptu conversation that we're going to have about a kind of decompression after Makerfield, because it was an intense month leading up to it. I'm joined by Charlie Downs and Connor Tomlinson, and so what do we think of the result overall then, chaps?
Well, I do need a decompression after that period because it was intense. It was very enjoyable, though. And on the whole, I was very happy with the result, as was the rest of the team. 7% from a standing start with no campaigning infrastructure in the constituency at the beginning of the by-election is a very good result.
I was a bit more pessimistic about it. Again, I feel a slightly difficult position because, you know, guys at the top party brass base, the groomsmen at my wedding. Cheers for that. But I do think that if a stronger candidate had been selected, you probably would eat over 10%.
Maybe so. I mean, Rebecca was a good candidate. She was a local lass, very good on the doors, very good with the people. It was the case this was a national by-election run primarily on national issues. So, you know, that maybe should have been more of a consideration. But again, I think on the whole, Rebecca did play a fairly significant part in the result that we ended up getting, just purely because of how she came across to the thousands of people that she spoke to.
I do think that people are learning the wrong lessons all around. So it's not a national barometer. Like Burnham was uniquely popular in the north and people were using Burnham to get rid of Starmer and rescue the Labour Party, which is a brand that they affectively identify with. You know, my dad voted Labour, my granddad voted Labour, I've got to vote Labour. So I don't think he'll have the same success on the national stage, especially when the system continues to produce the same outcomes and Burnham will just be a different salesman than Starmer for the horrible products of that system. But I think Reform were almost, even though they didn't want you guys to get more, Reform were almost hoping you did in order to pin Burnham on you. Mm. And what Reform now have to do, and I think you sense a tiny bit of that in Farage's post-election video, that he was still trying to make a sales pitch saying to restore voters, what do you want? You know, not recycle Tories, but which was, he was hoping that you would have split the difference enough to blame it on you rather than have to turn around and say, why can't Reform win by-elections? Because they underperformed in Poaching's by-election, eking it out by only 6 votes. Matt Goodwin's campaign in Gorton and Denton was a disaster. And then not only did they fail to mount a sufficient defence of Rob Kenyon's bawdy jokes online, which I don't think he should have been crucified for. But they ran a purely negative campaign, whereas Burnham ran a very positive campaign and swept it.
The assumption underpinning Reform's complaint about us is that we are stealing voters from them who would ordinarily vote for Reform. And what we're finding with our support is that, sure, there are plenty of people that have come from Reform to vote for us, but that's because they view us as being what Reform should be. Mm. You know, we are the authentic version of what Reform sold themselves as, certainly in the 2024 general election, for example, because we are promising the things that the majority of people, a great many people, view as being the most pressing issues of our time, such as demographic security, mass deportations of illegal migrants, and a recognition of the fact that British identity is more than just values and paperwork. These are all issues that Reform have backtracked on. And so for Reform to stand there and say that they are owed those people's votes, I think they should basically look in the mirror and ask why they've lost them in the first place, which is to say nothing of the people who haven't voted for 20 years who are coming out in support of us, which is another significant kind of constituency that we are activating. Why is it that Reform can't activate that constituency? And I would suggest, as you said, Connor, that it's because those people view the figure of Farage and the people that they've brought in, especially from the Conservative Party, as just being more of the same.
I mean, there was the giveaway line in Nigel Farage's video. We are the challenger party to the left.
Mm.
No, you're not. You are the used car salesman of the right, which is why you had to appeal to those thousands of people in Makerfield. What do you want? Mm. Well, I would like some authenticity, actually. I want someone who doesn't come across as if he's trying to sell me a vehicle that's had its mileage wound back by a few thousand miles. Mm. You know, this has always been a problem with Farage's persona of the Jack the Lad.
Mm.
It's fundamentally doesn't come across very serious. I mean, you say they underperformed in a bunch of areas. They also underperformed at the local elections and they underperformed in Makerfield. As again, Farage said, he expected 18,000 votes. They got 16,000. We'll explain the 3,000 that went over to Restore then.
Well, also their vote share declined as a percentage share from the local elections by about 16%.
Yes. And I think really that your point about Makerfield not being a bellwether is the most important one that people need to take away. Because I think that on the right, we have tr- trouble putting ourselves in the frame of someone who is on the left, or at least I'm not even sure if left and right is correct way to form it.
Well, I was going to say that. I mean, the fact that Farage frames it in terms of taking on the left. Yeah. I mean, most people don't care about these terms. Exactly. And plenty, by the way, plenty of our voters, I think at some point or another, would have described themselves as being left-wing because sure. they have this old school idea of what that means.
Yeah, because, I mean, what like the old school Labour voters aren't what I would consider to be left-wing
no.
right? in the modern full spectrum sense. Because, I mean, there's the amazing sort of 4chan green text that goes around and says, look, you can repudiate any economic position you want. You can hold any theory on the state or anything like that. But the second you repudiate trans rights, you're no longer left wing. And it's like, right, okay, that's what left wing really is then. Right. And that's the sort of socially conservative blue Labour, Maurice Glassman types who populate the North. You know, what they expect is economic fairness from the imperial centre in London. They understand that they do the hard work in the industrial North and they want just recompense. They want compensation for that. And I think that's quite understandable. And I think this is why essentially Makefield, I'm not even sure if the right had a path to power here, because Andy Burnham's pitch was basically, we're going to restore the Labour Party.
Well, it's interesting. His slogan was for us.
Yes.
On his billboards and everything. And I always think that only makes sense when you say it in a Northern accent. That slogan.
I mean,
because that's what he's saying. He's saying it's so that we, people of the North, have some representation.
Yeah, and this is what Restore Britain is to people like me, where it's like, well, I want some representation as well. And so Andy Burnham was actually taking a very deeply conservative approach to his campaign with Northern voters. He was saying, look, I'm here to because the premise being the Labour Party has been captured by the human rights lobby, what the left calls the Labour Right, the sort of human rights technocrats. And I want to return it to being the party of patronage for the working North and Wales and places like that, right? Because this is something that ancestrally, as you were pointing out, this is what they'd always relied on. This was their kind of like a Pokemon or something. Like this is the thing we send out to fight the powers that be and make sure that we get a fair deal.
They're the ambassadors for their region and their right. sort of protective group.
It's the same kind of almost like ethnic patronage that we see in like the Greens.
I was going to say the same thing. It's essentially the Northern version of the Liberal Democrats.
Or the Northern version of the Greens.
Yes.
Or the Northern version of like, you know, the Muslim independence or whatever. Like that. And I think a lot of them genuinely feel a nostalgia for a time when the Labour Party was genuinely on their side, right? When they felt the Labour Party was their party and they could trust the Labour Party to give them a good deal out of things. And so I think the scale of Andy Burnham's win came as a surprise to everyone. But in retrospect, if you look at the campaign that he'd run and what he was offering, again, very like a return to tradition campaign, actually it's not surprising that he won because he was running the right-wing campaign that Farage's entirely negative campaign. Like, what was Farage's campaign slogan?
I couldn't tell you. I mean, it was get Starmer out at the locals, which they've now done.
To block Burnham.
Exactly.
Which was we've the got only to stop way to get
Burnham.
Rid of Starmer.
But Burnham isn't like Sauron or something, you know. Keir Starmer is Sauron. And you'd already run on the vote reform, get Starmer out. Well, he was like, yeah, but I can actually get Starmer out. And look what happened today.
Mm.
Burnham has actually delivered on that. So this was a deeply, like, Burnham is currently going through his own Lord of the Rings narrative, right? He has literally gone to them as the hobbits and said, look, you have to back me and I will take the ring to Mordor and we will topple Sauron. And he is currently on that hero's journey right now. It's just that we don't think in the same terms, but I think this is persuasive. I think Northerners are thinking these terms. And that's why when he said, look, I kept getting this on the doorstep, this is your last chance. Like you, if you don't do this and you sell us out, that's it. We'll never vote for Labour again. Well, and I think he genuinely believes it.
Well, it was fascinating because on many of the doors, sure, there were people saying, oh, I'm split between you and Reform and I'm worried about splitting the vote and all the rest of it. But there were also plenty of people who said, I'm split between you and Labour because, you know, they sensed that there was something possibly uniting the two, that there was they represented a similar sort of tendency within the British soul at this moment. And that is a desire for some kind of restoration.
But bizarrely,
Burnham was able to present himself in that way, you know.
Burnham's got the history and credentials in the area to be able to easily win that narrative. But basically, Restore and Burnham were presenting the same narrative to the people of Makefield, which I found fascinating. But Connie, go on.
Well, I was going to say, if we're looking at this in terms of client groups, which most politicians do, I think Reform are worried at the moment. Yes, by Restore nipping at their heels on their rightward flank, but because Burnham represents a falling back into old habits in tribal loyalties to Labour of the northern working class, because reform essentially has three core constituencies that it's banking on to deliver them a majority, and that is Essex, the North, and pensioners.
Yeah.
And if you look at the graphs, I think, loath though I am to cite them, the graphs that the Spectator posted, because this morning Keir Starmer resigned, so another thing to throw into the mix. The main point that his polling started to dip below subterranean levels was actually the cancellation of winter fuel payments. Mm. If you estrange the pensioners, this is the calculation reforms clearly made with its triple lock, even though it can't be funded, it's destroying the prospects mm-hmm. of the young. Many pensioners realise this. But what they've guaranteed is if you annoy Simon and Linda, you lose. Yeah. And so reform have locked up the pensioners. They have locked up Essex and confiscated it from the Tories because they are a very Dino-coded party. Like, they've got football shirts, for God's sake. And the Conservatives decided to put Kemi Badenoch, first-generation Nigerian anchor baby, in place. And, yeah. and weirdly enough, the Love Island viewers aren't so keen on that one. Mm. And then they were banking on the white working class in the north. And they've consecutively estranged them by either their inconsistent economic policies. I also don't think having Jemrick as their economic spokesman is going to win over many people in the north, not just because he presents as a Tory, but because his...
I wonder why he presents as a Tory.
Well, there you go. But yeah, he's still yeah. yeah. But his economic philosophy clearly codes establishment, and establishment is synonymous with Thatcherism, Blairism.
Well, it's the sort of thing that's signed off by George Osborne, who exactly. cried at Thatcher's funeral.
Quite.
So,
whereas Burnham can credibly turn around and say, even though he was a Blairite, a Brownite, a Corbynite, and now...
A Starmer, right?
Yes. He can turn around and say, the legacy of neoliberal economics and Thatcher closing the mines has deracinated our communities, therefore I'm going to be your advocate. If they lose the white working class in the north, they lose overall.
Yeah.
And so I think they're probably panicked about the prospect of Burnham over time bribing that constituency with infrastructure projects. Obviously, Manchesterism is unaffordable, but Burnham might just make the calculation, well, I'll leave this fiscal time bomb for the next government, even if I get voted out. And so that's why I think they're already calling for a general election this morning yeah. is because their calculation is, okay, Burnham won't have enough time to bribe the electorate. The Tories are in total disarray. Their surrogates like Jacob Rees-Mogg won't have time to advocate for our guys to factor a post-election coalition into their risk management calculations, yeah. which means that you start prepping your policy for a coalition, which is what they want. The Lib Dems are basically a national non-entity. The Greens don't have demographics on our side. And... Restore aren't ready for a government yet, even though we aren't ready for a government. You know, we're a bit further down the road with third institutions and pre-drafted legislation and a few candidates. So they're kind of hoping that Burnham makes the faux pas of calling a snap election because he needs a new mandate to govern, a new manifesto in order to borrow for his spending plans, because they just don't want to lose the North. And they're reading it as a national bellwether.
But also, I think you're right. I don't think reform can hold the North, right? Because I think that what happens with Makefield could happen elsewhere is that essentially Burnham outflanks reform from the right. Mm. He says, no, we're the part, I'm going to give you patriotism in a way that we Southerners don't really understand Northern patriotism. Andy Burnham lent very much in there, the language of the familiar, the local, the personal for us, mm. right? He recognizes that actually he can put himself as the Hobbits versus Mordor and lean into that right-wing patriotism through left-wing economics. And what's Farage going to do about that? He can't sell Thatcherism in the North. He can only sell the negative campaign. Or keep Andy Burnham out. Well, I mean, more than half of Makefield, Andy Burnham looks like a saviour. He looks like a hero. You can't say, keep your hero out. No. You failed to read the situation and the relationship that those people have with the Labour Party. And it was Keir Starmer breaking that relationship and previous Labour leaders breaking that relationship that is the problem. And so having this entirely negative campaign, like you said, what was the campaign slogan in Makefield? I actually don't know. I was just Googling it before. It was just, as far as I could tell, keep Burnham out. So why didn't you have a snappy slogan? Mm. You know, make her feel great again or something. I don't know, whatever it is. But you don't have a positive vision. And that was, of course, the problem with Gordon and Denton. That's been the problem, I mean, literally with the local elections was vote reform, get Starmer out. It's just, we just don't like that guy. Okay, but what are you for? And at this point, nobody knows.
It does make me laugh that various reform figures this morning were kind of reposting the Get Starmer Out graphic saying,
yeah.
see, promises made.
Yeah,
and it's just like, you know, it's so funny.
Well, there were loads of Graham Taylor and James Orr both posted it as well. It's like, oh, really, you're taking credit for this, are you?
Mm.
You
know? But I do think this whole Burnham kind of phenomenon is interesting because it does speak to the fact that there is something like a kind of package of ideas that the majority of people in the country could get behind.
Yeah.
But all the various different forces on the landscape landscape are only getting at certain aspects of it. Like Burnham might be getting at the kind of, I suppose what you could call the left wing aspect of it, the kind of the economic side of it. But he does bring with that a certain, you know, he wears, someone described him as Starmer in jeans, right? So he does have that kind of earthy, kind of homely kind of thing about him. But he is still ultimately, you know, an establishment shill, a globalist and all the rest of it. And plenty of people know that, but plenty of people don't. And so my view is that Restore basically has to be the party that presents the British people with the full package. Mm. Like, yes, you've got the patriotism, the mass deportations, the securing the demographic future of the country, but you also have to recognise that plenty of people are not up for more kind of neoliberal economics, more Thatcherism and all the rest of it. And this is obviously, we're a young party. This is a conversation that is ongoing. But it does seem to me that there is this kind of, I don't want to say perfect kind of agenda, but something close to that, an agenda that will get, you know, not just like Reform voters, not just Labour voters, not just Tory voters, but non-voters and people from all parties together looking at it and thinking, actually, that is something I can get behind.
There's been polling done that shows that the country is actually socially conservative, but economically left-wing.
Yeah. Right?
So and nobody occupies that space because no ideology can actually find a coherent and consistent platform in that location, which is ironic and probably quite disappointing for the average person in the country. But I think we have a habit of kind of homogenizing the country when we think in terms of economics. The South does not want Burnhamite socialism.
Yes.
We are an entrepreneurial, honestly, petty bourgeois country in the South. But in the North, they're not that, right? They're not entrepreneurial. They're the industrial heartlands where, for them, it was a like lifelong commitment. Oh yeah, my grandfather mined the steel that was used in the ships that, you know, kept the British Empire winning everywhere. We don't think like that in the South. And so actually having a discrete plan for both sides might actually be more useful rather than saying, right, okay, look, it's Thatcherite neoliberalism or it's essentially Soviet Burnhamism.
Yeah.
You know, like I don't want either of those things.
This is the issue with Reform's sales pitch, because all of their economic dynamism rests on the looking for growth, AI optimization, drone factories, things like that. And that plays pretty well, specifically in SW1, but it will play pretty well in the South. And they are the technologies of the future, fine. Of course, you know, there are business interests in Dubai that link to the party that are very interested in ensuring those are the things of the future. But nevertheless, they might be prosperous and necessary to compete internationally. However, when you have someone like Richard Tice supervising that industrial strategy, that energy security, that sovereign wealth fund, then how's he going to go up to a northern town and say, well, we're going to attract this incredible investment company, there's going to be AI stations? Your average northern voter is just going to look at him like, but that's not my grandfather's industry. And they've only made slight rhetorical overtures to steel when there was that nationalization debate under Starmer.
Yeah.
You need to make more of that. You need to be talking more about, they've promised to scrap net zero, they've promised to like revoke the Climate Change Act. Fine. Talk about the kinds of energy generation industry that you're going to be developing in the North. Talk about the kinds of steel and shipbuilding, the kinds of like rearmament industries that actually, to be fair, to his credit, Farage can absolutely talk about because he's got a comprehensive knowledge of like military history and that. It's very strange that they aren't making that pitch. And I think it's because, as you said, they've either homogenized the country or the people that they've got on their sort of economics team aren't thinking about regional sales pitches. They're just thinking about courting investment.
Because, I mean, like, the one thing that I've said this before, and it drives me mad, that we the Southwest is as Brexit voting area as anywhere else, and yet we're ruled by the Lib Dems. And it's because the Lib Dems are essentially we're nice people and we're not going to get involved in the way that you run your affairs. And it's like, okay, great, because we always vote Conservative Lib Dem down here. Of course, the Conservatives have died off. So we're saddled with the Lib Dems. Well, okay, give us a regional sales pitch, which is we're going to cut business rates or something. So the local like farm owner or shop owner or whatever is like, oh, great, you know, I'd love to save some money. And then for the Southwest, be like, yeah, this is going to be like our Britain's national global forward-facing like outward, you know, with the City of London and all the AI doodads and whatever. But then you go to the North and say, right, we're gonna pick up the right wing narrative on why nationalization is good.
Yep.
Nationalization for xenophobic reasons. Right. That's expressly the argument, because you go, okay, why is the electricity? Why is the rail? Why is the water? Why are these owned by foreign companies? And in fact, the rail itself is owned by foreign governments. Like, this isn't even a free market. This is nonsense. Why are we letting the Chinese outcompete us on steel? No, no, no. To protect British workers, protect British steel, protect British industry, protect British services and utilities, nationalise because foreigners. Mm. Right? That's the argument that you can pitch to the North, and suddenly you have essentially, you've got the sort of Andy Burnham argument from the right, which is what they want to hear, an Andy Burnham argument. We want to know we're being looked after. But you're also arguing on free market principles, as in, these are natural monopolies. There is no capitalism when I'm getting on the train, right? The trains, like, for example, you guys got the train here. You've got one train line. You have not got any capitalism there. There is no competition. You have absolutely no choice. So the capitalist argument, even the sort of like the Southeast Londoners, can understand that even from a capitalist lens, these are not competitive industries that we need to be talking about. We need to be talking about them from a national security position. Mm-hmm. So this is what, if there are, you know, great shockwaves, Russia invades somewhere or whatever, you know, the Straits of Hormuz are closed, whatever, we need these things for national security. And so you've got the right-wing argument for nationalization, for protectionism for the North, but you keep the South open and free marketeer, low tax, you know, like entrepreneurial. And it is all there. I think you are.
Absolutely. I mean, that to me sounds like the economic agenda of the future. Is, right. You know, basically, I mean, it's different names for it, but something like economic nationalism.
But it's kind of regionalism as yeah. well. But it's obviously, it's like, you know, what's good for the region and what do the people of the region actually look for?
Well, that's what happened prior to sort of globalization and empire, because the ability to organize a nation when you didn't have instant communications technology, when it would take days for the king's messages to reach the feudal baron, you had different regional cultures and cottage industries and things like that. And so you could almost recover that way of doing things and revive regional cultures through an economic agenda that allowed for that different specification. And as you said, like, it could be a national security issue. So it's not just about energy and manufacturing repatriation, but for example, anticipating some tumult in the South China Sea and Taiwan going belly up, shouldn't we have our own even marginal like chip manufacturing capacity? Shouldn't
Well, forgetting anything that advanced, I mean, 80% of our key prescription pharmaceuticals come from China and India.
Yeah.
Like, is that a good idea?
And there's loads in Israel as well.
Yeah.
Which is, of course, not a stable region.
Steel, energy, food as well. 40% of our food we import. I mean, how is that sustainable? And most people are at some level aware of this, you know?
And I think it's a very hard argument to make against as well. It's like the arguments for globalization have clearly withered on the vine, and the world has changed around them, and they haven't changed. So I think we can easily win those arguments. And so you can out-burn and burn them from the right, because ultimately I think he will find himself in a weaker position because of his sort of universalist left-wing tendencies.
Well, every other party other than, I would assume, you guys are... They see globalization and trade as a means of international diplomacy with countries we actually don't like very much. Yeah. Like, the Indians are demographically gerrymandering our country.
Yeah.
Like, they call it the Living Bridges Program. And yet, Starmer signed a new trade deal with India that, of course, has loads of visas attached to it. And then when Farage went to the World Economic Forum, which could have been a really smart move, basically go to the globalist home and tell them what for, he sat down and said, we've abandoned India, we've ignored it. And I've heard behind the scenes from reform surrogates that I've spoken to, trying to talk to their rationale about that, they said, look, we get loads of our silks from India, we get loads of exports from India, and in order to keep getting these products, we have to accept at least an amount of Indian immigration. And, okay, well...
As if Indians are going to refuse money. Of course they're not just going to refuse money.
Exactly. And like Restore have already said, okay, we're putting India on the red list. Like, we don't really care about that. So I think you would be able to outflank any other party on the grounds of economic protection and prioritizing people's interests by just saying, sorry, we're not going to trade away our domestic industries just to keep another country happy that wants to send loads of its foreign nationals over to us anyway.
Yeah. I think it's also about just literally doing what works. Like, it shouldn't be that complicated, but it's obvious that markets and competition are amazing engines for innovation and efficiency. And you shouldn't have a kind of dogmatic view that, oh, free market capitalism is acidic and awful wherever it takes place, as the left do.
Or but it's just a... an unvarnished bounty wherever.
But equally, that's what I was going to say. Yeah. But equally, it's not a good thing everywhere either, because mass immigration is one kind of function of free market capitalism, in my view. And so, you know, a free market economy within the bounds of the national interest is my view on what we need. And then when the free market activity goes beyond those bounds, that's when you say, that's where you stop.
Query is obviously as someone who's like friendly to the project, but, you know, regional organizer, spokesman. So I'm just encouraging things. But is there not a tension between the philosophy we're discussing now and the affinity that Rupert has for Ayn Rand and Thatcher is, I mean, he's of the generation that calls her Mrs. Thatcher. he does extol the virtues of that kind of free market entrepreneurialism in less regional particular or Anglo ways and almost more ideological ways. Is there a tension there? Has this been discussed?
I would say a tension is probably too strong a way of putting it. I mean, there's, you know, spirited debate within the party about all matters, including economics. It's certainly the case that Rupert belongs to a generation of men who view Thatcher and her ideas as being only a good thing, you know, the saviour of the country. I and those my kind of age within the party don't share that view. I mean, it's obvious to me that what Thatcher did at that time was in certain respects necessary, but now it's obvious that the consequences of that have been equally terrible. Yeah. You know, the condition of certain northern towns, for example, yeah. Post-industrial Britain, that has just been, for some reason, also flooded with migrants. You go to these towns and it's just bleak. So the idea that you reheated Thatcherism, you know, Thatcherism for the 21st century is what we need, I don't agree with that. And I think if you spoke to Rupert, his view would be a lot more nuanced than just Thatcherism again. Like, he's very open to the idea of nationalisation of key sectors. We've got an economics paper, policy paper coming out in the very near future where we do outline our economic agenda. And it does, in my view, take the best from both worlds, as I was just describing. We take the best of free market capitalism and the growth, I hate that word. It's so, like, establishment.
It's very cliche, anyway, isn't it?
Yeah. But the efficiency, the innovation that free market capitalism can deliver when it's situated properly, but also the security that a more kind of nationalist, you know, perspective, protectionist perspective can also bring. Yeah. And that's the beauty of it. Because we are not operating within the bounds of the establishment left and yeah. right, we can actually just take what's good but from all sides.
I think Connor does raise a valid point, though. I think what you're arguing or questioning is... how ideologically bounded is Rupert? Because in a way, I don't think it's entirely his fault, because remember, at his age, he grew up and was an adult all through the Cold War. Right? The Cold War is a deeply ideological conflict.
Economics were the question of the time, yeah.
It's not just economics, though. The economics are deeply informed by an ideological perspective. And the question is, which ideology is correct?
Yep.
Which ideology gets us to the end of history? It turned out it was capitalism, which was... Okay, great, but I actually don't want to be at the end of history. You know, the whole premise was false to begin with. But from this perspective, you can see why Rupert Lowe's view on Thatcherism, neoliberalism, and Ayn Rand actually is more of a reflection of the average Englishman's instinct, as in, let me just run my business. Because
yeah.
he, of course, owns a family business as well. So let me just run my business, charge me minimal tax, and don't get involved with regulation or anything like that, and I'll do a good job of it. That really is what the theorists, the Austrian theorists, were abstracting out of anyway to form the ideology. And in a deeply ideological age like the 80s, you needed an ideology to be able to argue your case. But I do agree with you. That time has passed, and... actually taking the best of both worlds is a good thing.
But why not? I mean, we shouldn't restrict ourselves to just being capitalists or whatever. And Rupert does, I mean, obviously you'd have to speak to Rupert if you want to understand his view of things. I'm not going to speak on his behalf, but I can speak on the party's behalf. And our view, certainly my view, is that there's no reason to restrict ourselves to just being capitalists or just being socialists and all that sort of thing. Because yeah. I think there's good and bad in both of those things. And taking the good out of them just makes perfect sense for a time of unprecedented global volatility, where we do have to be self-sufficient, where we do have to be looking after ourselves, looking out for ourselves, looking out for our people, not one... selling them off, you know, selling off their jobs, offshoring their jobs, offshoring our industries.
Or indeed also
bringing in cheap labor to undercut them at home. That's obviously a terrible thing to do. Yeah. Equally, it would be a terrible thing to have the state own every aspect of the country. That's equally disastrous. But there is an in-between between those two things.
And this, weirdly enough, is another one of Andy Burnham's strengths, is... Everyone's trying to go, oh, what's his ideology? And as you made the joke, you know, a Blairite, a Brownite, and now a Starmerite walk into a bar and everyone's like, oh, hello, Andy. That's actually to his strength. And I don't know why people don't understand that Andy Burnham being pragmatic and flexible is actually going to help him win and do well at whatever he does. Because he can just respond and say, okay, we won't do more of that then because that was a mistake. We'll do this. We'll try that. And, you know, very trial and error sort of pragmatic approach. but it means he can respond to events as they occur. And I definitely think that Restore Britain should take that
approach. I think what's interesting as well is you begin with like who is, you talked earlier about the client groups, like who is the constituency that you're seeking to serve? Hmm. And with Burnham, again, the kind of right-wing aspect of his agenda is that it's for us.
Yeah.
Like that is a kind of...
deeply nativist.
Yeah, it's a kind of nativist, Northern, nationalist kind of view.
It's explicitly.
Yeah. But equally... If your starting point for a national economic agenda is for us, yeah. which is Restore's view, you know, Britain first, yeah. that's our view on every area yeah. of policy, then that does mean you come out with solutions that are not easily categorized as left or right or capitalist or socialist. But it's pragmatic.
Moreover, the way I think Restore Britain can outflank Andy Burnham on this, on the sort of nativism, is that Andy Burnham is he's pitching the North against the South. He's saying, I'm going to go and fight the South, the neoliberal view of the South, on behalf of the North. I was like, okay, but I actually don't want a civil war in my country. I'd like a reasonable dispensation, right? It is true that in the South, we do not want high tax, overbearing government. And it is true in the North that you want security from the predations of rampant capitalism. There is an accommodation to be made here that serves both interests. Mm-hmm. And actually, like I was saying, the... non-competition argument will smooth it over with the South. I think you can win the South over by saying, look, you know, the steel is not a competition argument anymore. Now it's a national security argument. There's no free market to be had when China's sending over slave steel made by, you know, peasants who are producing absolute crap and whatnot. No, that's not safe for us. It's not good. It doesn't work. And then the market, no competition with the trains and things like that. I think this is all completely winnable, but it also doesn't pit the country against itself. It is a positive message because in Andy's message, I'm not sure he'll ever win over the South. Mm. I really don't think he will. I'm sure that he's a perfectly nice guy and I'm sure he's very popular in the North. But I look
covered up grooming gangs, so not that nice.
Well, yeah, okay. But which one didn't? You know, they all bloody did that. But that's not what the focus of the conversation will be. And I'm just thinking about people like my dad or my wife's dad. You know, what are they thinking? You know, they're men of the Southwest. What are they thinking about Andy Burnham? They just think he's a communist, right? And it's just like, well, he's not a communist, but they don't want to hear it. You know, he's just like, oh, big government, going to get in your face, going to get your taxes up. And it's like, okay, no, I don't want this. So Andy Burnham's really going to struggle winning those sorts of people over. And they are just normal guys who have worked their whole lives and just don't want to pay taxes.
And also, if you are incapable of defining the us properly as one which feels like it's prioritising the British people, their preferences and prejudices first and foremost, then in crisis moments, because if Burnham isn't in a hurry to call an election, decides he wants to cling on for a bit, when the next inevitable Harry Novak murder or Southport happens, or even the recent attempted stabbings in Edinburgh, or when these moments happen where the febrile ethnic and religious tensions in this country come to a head, you are forced to pick a side. And you, if you're like Starmer, where you don't have that political agility that you're attributing to Burnham, you will fall back on the rules and received rhetoric and declare the full force of the law will be brought down on the far right, which is an ideological moniker for the English people. The English people, the British people who refuse to have their identity liquidated into this new UK and who have the audacity to grieve a bunch of butchered girls who are one of their own, taken by not one of their own. And if this us is either us plus or us including or an us that seeks to reconstitute a national identity without the nation itself, which is what Wes Streeting basically said in his letter, bowing down before Burnham, saying that Burnham is the only person that we can rely on in the fight of our lives against nationalism, so against the British people. If your us quite clearly in these crisis moments does not put the British people first and foremost, or is not exclusively the British people, then you will be coded as an enemy, no matter what.
I don't think the right can rely on that. Starmer's reaction, I think that the final nail in the coffin for Starmer was Southport.
Yeah.
It was utterly unrecoverable from that point onwards. Everyone hated him because he literally just came out and said, I'm against you because you're British.
Yes.
Right? That's what everyone took from it. Burnham won't do that.
I think he'd be more sympathetic in his speech, but if the state responds in the same way, like millions more security to mosques and things like that.
But it wasn't even that. I think people would have quite easily accepted millions more in security to mosques. His problem was 24-hour courts, full force of the law for you being white British. That was the issue. Burnham won't do that. He's not a human rights lawyer. That's not his natural instinct. I actually think that when a tragedy happens, and it will, under Burnham, actually, he'll come out, he'll look haggard, he'll look sad, and he'll give, actually, I think, quite a sympathetic speech where he says, look, this is terrible. I'd just like us to all calm down. We're going to get the police to, you know, arrest the bad guy, make sure that, you know, the people in the hospitals are given the best treatment we can get them. He'll give quite a human speech. And
like,
that one,
he was at the Don't Look Back in Anger vigil for Manchester Arena,
yeah,
for example.
Yeah, exactly. He's got experience doing this, right? It's not, he's not going to make himself hated in the way that Keir Starmer does. So the right definitely shouldn't rely on that. He'll, you know, go down to a negative opinion because everyone has a negative opinion of every bloody politician. But it'll be on the economics that he doesn't win over the South, I think. But it likewise can be on the economics that Restore could win over the North.
Mm.
You've just got to make sure that you can present like a whole of country approach rather than just, oh, we're going to use the North to attack the South.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I agree. And as I said, our paper is coming out very soon on this.
I look forward to seeing it.
Yeah, no, it should be good. I've glanced over the first draft and it is very strong. I mean, my view is that we have to have a completely new framework for thinking about economics in the 21st century, because the whole capitalism versus socialism thing, it's a Cold War, yeah, you know, holdover that's not really relevant anymore.
Yeah, it's anachronistic.
Yeah, because, you know, for example, like the NHS, as an example, and I get flack for this for sometimes, like the NHS in its current form obviously needs to be basically torn down and rebuilt from the ground up.
Yeah.
But the NHS as a concept, everybody paying into a pot so that when one of us is ill, we can take out and not go homeless, perfectly logical, in my view, and a policy of any self-respecting country. Does that make me a socialist? Obviously not. Equally, state ownership or at least state involvement in certain key strategic sectors like energy, like steel, like medicine, like food for that matter, all of these things that without we die as a nation, perfectly logical. Equally, do we want to fall behind when it comes to our ability to solve problems? No, definitely not. Like, and especially the new problems that the 21st century is going to present. So we do want to be a place where innovation can happen, where those who are entrepreneurial and risk-taking are able to take risks, and if those risks pay off, be rewarded for them. You know, that combination is a winner, in my view.
Yeah.
And again, restricting ourselves to these old frameworks is a mistake. And I think that goes not just for economics, but for every other area. Our de facto slogan right now, and we ran a nationwide billboard campaign on this, as you know, one of them was in Swindon, is a party that will put the British people first.
Yeah.
And that is our central principle. Anything that benefits the British people, defined as the indigenous people of these isles, is what we will do.
Good. That's what I'd like to see. I mean, weirdly enough, the economic situation sort of between John Major and Tony Blair is actually what it sounds like you're describing.
Mm.
You know, we had the NHS, we had all of these things, and yet we didn't have an insane overbearing tax burden. So if we can just try and, you know, rein those things in, but go on, Colin, what's with the expression?
Well, demographics were different.
Yes, exactly.
And if we're going back to the conversation about which demographics you're seeking to win over as your reliable electoral factions, saying that you're going to do something to the triple lock or saying you're going to restructure the NHS, no matter how efficient that might be, and I would agree, you know, it's completely unfundable, it's a fiscal black hole, and with two kids on the way, I just can't tell you how many bad experiences we've already had. Like, they missed a baby the first time, so, you know, completely incompetent. Nevertheless, the moment you say, we're going to restructure the NHS, or in your own words, we're going to tear it to the ground and rebuild it from the ground up, you will do the pensioner equivalent of host scaring.
Mm.
And
well, potentially, I mean, on the triple lock, you know, it is our policy to essentially get rid of it because it's completely unsustainable and it's screwing over the youth of this country. Yeah. We're confident, to be totally frank, that we've made the calculation. Yes, pensioners and those over the age of 60 tend to vote in far greater numbers than those who are under the age of 30. But there is an increasing politicisation of young people. Many of them are going to the Green Party, obviously, because they're looking at the Green Party as being the only kind of radical option that doesn't kind of trip their, sort of state indoctrinated minds about things like racism and sexism and all the rest of it. But they do, the Green Party presents themselves as being radicals when they are, in fact, you know, more of the same on steroids.
Yeah.
But I'm confident, and we're confident, that if the youth of Britain are presented with a party that is explicitly going to put their interests first, which is going to do things which make their lot better, I'm pretty confident that we're going to be able to convince a huge number of people so that losing the pensioners, I think, is an overstatement, because I think a great many pensioners will recognise that actually maybe it is not sustainable for my generation to be taking from the pockets of the younger generation?
I'm not saying they won't, because I would include my own grandparents past and still alive in this. What I am saying is you need to sell it with a bedside manner.
Yeah,
and, of course.
Don't get me wrong, I'm guilty of this as well. The very energetic and almost provocative way that we rambunctious young Zoomers put things across do rally the troops. However, you need to, I'm not saying you specifically, I'm saying we broadly.
The party.
Collect. Yeah, the party, the movement on the whole, yep. Need to mix up the voices. And one of the best things that J.D. Vance did, actually, in the 2024 election, no matter how one feels about him, is that when they were trying to beat him with the J.D. Vance's weird stick, mm-hmm. he actually just came across like a very reassuring voice. Like mm-hmm. Tim Walz in that debate looked like a Jim Henson character, mm-hmm. whereas he almost took the audience's side. And many women actually thought, oh no, he just seems like a normal dad. He's actually quite sensible. Yeah. You need those sorts of tones and deliveries in it, which is, so my follow-up question is going to be, okay, you got the by-election out of the way. Of course, there's this looming Greater Manchester mayoral election now, but park that to one side for a minute. Barring any by-elections eating up all of your time and political capital and planning capacity, are you going to expand the team's spokespeople for different issues and different departments? Because it's excellent that, you know, Harrison's producing the papers and you've got loads of detail, but not everyone is a subject matter expert even after reading those really detailed papers, and you need to be able to have people that can be called upon for those subject matters so people can't be wrong-footed on given issues. So is that in the works?
Well, it was our intention to kind of go into phase two of Restore Britain after the local elections,
right.
But obviously then the Makerfield by-election yeah. happened, and that was kind of then, you know, pushed to one side
yeah.
For the moment. But now that that's out of the way, it is absolutely our intention to expand our team, to have more spokespeople, especially spokespeople who are specialists on their, you know, subject, produce more policy, obviously open more branches across the country, and basically professionalize, turn into a proper political party. Because it does remain the case that we're a very small team, which has its advantages, but increasingly, you know, with the level of support that we have, the sheer number of people that we have to organize nationally, it's definitely the case that we need a larger team. So yeah, that's absolutely our intention. And one, you know, there's going to be various announcements over the next few weeks related to that, one of which is the launch of our youth wing, of course, which I will be heading up. And I am confident, just going on from what we were just talking about, that will go a long way to reassuring, or demonstrating to the youth of Britain that this is the party for them, that we understand their plight.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, I am a youth, you know?
Yeah, yeah, well, you know, I think following on from Connor's point, I am concerned about the representative demographics of Restore that are not necessarily representative of actually the core of the party.
Sure. Yeah.
So, of course, we've all been to lots of the meetings, and the average age is probably about my age.
Yeah.
It's mums and dads who are concerned about the future of the country. I would really like to see some of those voices front and centre. You know, not to name any names, but we've seen, especially out of the Makerfield campaign, a few certain middle-aged stars wandering around with their sons saying, well, this is how, these are all the problems and this is what we've got to do. It's like, well, that's great, because, I mean, you know, I think you guys are doing a great job, right? I think you're all doing a great job. But there is something to be said about you being too young and fresh-faced for the older generations to consider you to have the kind of lifelong experience that I think they're expecting to see in politicians.
Well, if things continue to go the way they are, I will probably look about 50 in about 5 years' time.
That's so good. But I'm not joking. I think...
I see your point. No, I do see your point.
I do think get some of the people who have shown themselves to be reliable, sensible, and articulate. Give them representative positions. Like, you know, so-and-so is a representative for men's issues or for women's issues or for whatever, you know, domain that they happen to have, and get them out on the media giving good informative talks about the things that are important to them. So it shows that the party isn't just, it's Rupert, who is the patrician, and then the sort of young outriders. Mm. Well, I want to see the people in the middle, right? I want to see those represented, because as a married business-owning father, I need to see myself represented in that party. lots of people unconsciously be thinking that.
Yeah, no, that sounds very sensible to me.
Yeah, so yeah. Pass that on to the folks. Yeah, that's why I think these happen.
I do usually say to the people that accuse like me of being sort of too young and inexperienced, I often say only experience that you need to be a political activist in Britain in the 21st century is the experience of having grown up here and watched what has been done to our country.
That is totally true. And it's also about what the... You've got to be able to pitch things without having to explain them, right? So when it's, you know, some 50-year-old chap who's, you know, got wrinkles on his face and is explaining, when I spent 30 years working in a steel mine or a steel works and this is what we learned, blah, 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 you can't do that. Mm. Whereas, you know, and that's the main burden of youth.
Yeah.
You've got all the energy, but you haven't got those stories. And I know there are lots of people in Restore who do have those stories. So I think putting those people in their appropriate positions in the party is definitely the next thing to think
about. Yeah, no, that's perfectly sensible to me.
Yeah, yeah. Right, okay, was there anything else we needed to cover?
I mean, what do we reckon is going to happen after Starmer's resignation? What's the bet for the next year?
Yeah, that's a good point. I think Firas made this point before we started recording. But I do think that Reform needs to come out of campaigning mode, right? Because it's
Reform or Restore?
Restore. I'm very old, right? I'm old and I'm tired. Restore needs to come out of campaigning mode because it was a very high energy campaign, and you can tell that they were genuinely shocked by the number of people that we had out there. And I think they were surprised that we get 7% of the vote. You know, I mean, we were all, of course, hoping for more, but that's not a shabby result at all. Kept our deposit, made a significant national impression.
And in the face of dozens of hit pieces from all quarters of the mainstream media.
Yeah, they couldn't believe it. You know, the Brendan O'Neill joined, you know, the Daily Mail, joining the Guardian, going like, oh, no, these guys are Nazis. Oh, yeah, yeah, okay. Yeah. You know, that's pathetic. But the point is, I think now the party needs to reassess, decompress, and begin the process of, again, recruiting, persuading, and expanding its base further. Like, for example, I know that the Manchester mayoral election is coming up. It's like, well, what's the point, is my question, you know?
Well, look, I mean, it is our intention to stand in that. And there are very specific reasons for that, which will be made public once we announce formally our candidate. But often these elections are just a good opportunity to centre issues that may otherwise not get a hearing, which may otherwise be ignored by the mainstream. And so, you know, as I say, it's our intention to stand in Manchester. But as against the Makerfield by-election, it might sound counterintuitive, but it will probably require a lot less manpower because it's such a large area. So, I mean, it's 5 million people, I think. You know, it's a huge, huge sort of piece of land and a huge number of people to potentially canvass. So our view is that the air war is going to be where that particular election is won, which means that we don't need to mobilize, you know, thousands of our activists on quite such a regular basis as we did in, for example, Makerfield or Great Yarmouth. So we will be able to, we will have the capacity to continue to grow the team whilst that is going on.
Right. So I think it's worth setting expectations for that pretty soon, which is the demographics just do not favour it.
Well, that's definitely true.
It's just, as long as it's made very clear that this is essentially a platform for a particular issue that we're going to advance, that's fine. I just personally wouldn't waste the time, honestly. Because it's not even going to be a national issue, really. You know, like no one cares about Manchester mayoral elections outside of Manchester. So it's, you know, no one in the South. I think Andy Burnham's sort of salience in the South is, I think for a lot of Southerners, it's just like, oh, who? Oh, the mayor of Manchester, never heard of him. You know, like there are going to be loads of people like that on the train this morning going in. And Keir Starmer could resign because the mayor of Manchester. What, you know, like people are going to be piecing this together because he's not a big figure down here.
I do think it's important to remember that, you know, Restore is still, as a party, only 4 months old.
We're still very much
kind of finding our feet and all the rest of it. We've had great success in the last two sets of elections that we've stood in. But we are still, you know, we're hammering out our platform.
But this is why I think Firas's advice of stop campaigning now, worry about expanding the base, worry about solidifying, putting down roots, making sure that you're spreading the good news of Restore Britain is more important than trying to win any individual election now.
Yes.
Because my follow-on question for that would be, okay, let's say Burnham does decide he needs to call an early election. In what fit state is Restore to contest it? I'm not saying that he wouldn't run candidates, but obviously Rupert has said his intention is to win the 2029 election outright, which means standing a slate of candidates nationally, which means Lewis is going to have an awful lot of emails to answer. Yeah. But if there's a snap election called, like...
Oh, that's easy. That's easy. I mean, I'm not speaking on behalf of the party.
Yeah.
But here's what I'd do. Obviously, Great Yarmouth.
Yes.
Boston and Skegness.
Just dethrone Tice.
Yeah.
God bless him.
Boston and Skegness, the most Brexit voting area in the country. Mm. Tice is one of the least appealing politicians in the world.
I described him to... We spoke to New Statesman journalist, and the piece is coming out soon. Yeah. I described him as he thinks he is Hugh Grant in Love Actually, but he's actually Hugh Grant in Bridget Jones.
Oof. But that's the point, right? I bet if, say you get 1,000 activists, put 500 of them in Great Yarmouth to make sure that Rupert keeps his seat, even though that's probably a foregone conclusion at this point. I'd be surprised if they even bothered campaigning against him.
Yeah, it's a one-party stay.
After the success of Great Yarmouth first and the locals, you can tell they're just like, okay, yeah, whatever. But I would be targeting something like Boston and Skegness. I probably wouldn't bother with Clacton because Farage will be there and, you know...
Again, one-party state.
One-party state.
Well, I'm not even sure if it is.
I'm not even sure if it's that bad because it was only about 37% of the constituency that voted for Farage. But it's not...
But if it looks like Reform were going to win the next election, then the persuasive...
Yeah, exactly. The charisma of the office. Vote,
therefore... Yeah.
But Boston and Skegness, I think, is a...
Well, I actually think Reform would thank you for that.
Getting rid of Tice.
Yeah, because the internal faction wars are that Tice is a pain in the arse. He's the one that's been facilitating loads of the former Boris Wave cabinet ministers in. So, and nobody likes Isabel Oakeshott anyway. So the further you can put distance,
that's definitely true.
Her and even Farage, he might give you a period.
He doesn't even party anymore. So.
We've had plenty of conversations about this. My view personally is that if an early election is called, it would be best if we obviously running Great Yarmouth goes without saying, but then target a handful of other seats that we feel we can win, pour all of our resources into those and establish a kind of, you know, a bridgehead in Parliament as Reform did in 2024.
Yeah, you become the new Reform, basically.
Yeah, to keep them honest.
And then, because the way I've been looking at Restore, and again, it might not be popular with some of the viewers who think, no, rah, rah, we must win the next one, is how familiar are you guys with the history of Fidesz in Hungary?
Not very.
So Fidesz was Viktor Orban's party. Orban was one of the original founding members. Before he got voted out, he was in power for 20 of the last 36 years, and three of the cabinet ministers were three of the original founders. And they started out as a rural and student movement, anti-communist, photoshopping photos of Brezhnev kissing a man to take the piss out of the Union, right? 89 to 91, of course, Soviet Union falls apart, and the first government in Hungary is like a wet centre-right coalition government. And they don't really do much to actually dismantle the bureaucracy of the Soviet state. It's the sort of thing that I'm seeing out of Reform at the moment, where, like, if left to his own devices, Danny Krug will only deal in half measures. I've heard rumblings that basically they can put all this policy on paper about gutting the human rights act and that, but they don't want to replace any of the judges because that will be too extreme. And so people are saying, I know, it's frustrating.
Woke nonsense.
Yeah, quite. As Tice would say. So if they inadequately gut the state, or if they aren't prepared enough with a snap election to get their agenda through, then Restore could be an intergenerational political project which cultivates those annoyed mums and dads and the next generation of, like, Zuma politicians, while also establishing a parliamentary beachhead and trying to keep a damp government honest and also keeping the narrative alive and rescuing it from the failures of a Reform government, or, God forbid, you know, Reform and Conservative coalition, especially if that, like in Hungary, was succeeded by the left reanimating itself, because the communists came in for 8 years and then Fidesz came in and won and then was successful for the next 20.
Well, this was always the worry with Reform, was if they do win a government in 29 or whenever it ends up being, is that they will screw everything up, and then the left will be it'll be very easy for them to point to Reform and say, look at what happens when you put the right in power, and then the right is dead for another generation. And so I agree, that is really the role of Restore, is to be the, you know, the authentic sort of genuine article of what Restore, I should say, of what Reform are pretending to be. And I've always maintained that Restore is a, you know, decades long project, because I've always said I'm not going anywhere. The rest of the Zoomers on the team are not going anywhere. We're going to be in it for the long haul because we're in it for to save the country, because we love the country and for no other reason than that. Rupert is obviously of an older generation to us, and it's possible he will bow out of politics sooner than we do. But as I say, we're not going anywhere. And so if it is the case that we don't win the next election, and depending on when that is, I mean, if it's, you know, let's be real, if it happens, if it is called in the next six months, it's going to be a bloody difficult effort. But if, you know, come 2029, I think that is possible, because I think between now and then it is possible for us to show the British people that we are what this country needs. But even if we don't win a majority then, if we establish that, you know, kind of presence in Parliament come the next election, it's entirely possible, absolutely doable, and to win a government.
It's also important, just to put as an addendum to that, that unlike Farage, Rupert isn't saying, I'm going to retire in 2 years.
That's also true.
Even though he's, what, 5 or 6 years older than him?
I think 8 years older.
He looks so much healthier. Yeah. I think he's about 6 years older than him. Farage is 62, Rupert's 68.
Is that right? Okay.
But you wouldn't know by looking at their pictures, right? Rupert looks hale and hearty. Mm. He looks like a man in his 50s, you know?
That's what farming does.
Farage looks like a man in his 70s because he smokes and drinks and probably eats a lot of red meat. What was I going to say? I do think that's the strategy, but like, I think the advantage of Makefield is the fact that they responded to us as if we were a national party.
Yeah.
Right? This put us on the map.
That's
right. Wall to wall, yeah. We hate these guys. Okay, fine, but at least you recognize us as a power, as a threat. But I think that your perspective, you know, just target certain particular areas that are actually reliable. If there was a 2027 election, or one even later this year, I'm not comfortable with Restore being in a constant campaigning mode.
Mm.
We need to be in a sort of expansive mode and a persuasive mode. When you're in a campaigning mode, it's actually less persuasive than you think. It's about more about drawing the lines rather than slowly growing people across. Because I think in Makefield, I'm sure that the Restore internal polling was actually correct. I bet 24% of the constituency was sympathetic.
Mm-hmm.
It's just Andy Burnham's narrative was very powerful and very right-wing. So, okay, I'm sympathetic, yeah, but I'm still going to vote for Burnham because we're on a mission here, right?
People also hate Starmer. And that was another reason they voted for Burnham.
Yeah, I mean, it was all tied up in Burnham's narrative.
Yeah.
Like, we hate Starmer. We've got to save the Labour Party. Andy Burnham comes on a white horse, you know, shining. He's the guy to do it. And it worked, you know? Yeah. So, but yeah, I really think it's easy to feel that a party, especially a new one, should be in hardcore campaigning mode over and over. But I'm actually not sure that's wise. Mm. And it gives you a kind of air of desperation almost that you don't want to cultivate. What you want to cultivate is this quiet confidence that, okay, you know, we don't have to stand in every election, especially if we're not ready. But what we are doing is slowly but surely increasing and spreading and growing outside of their gaze.
And people do appreciate that. Like when we only stood in Great Yarmouth at the local elections, people
I thought that was sensible.
You know,
that was very sensible. And like, so not feeling that you have to challenge every election is definitely the attitude, because it speaks more of self-confidence rather than the sort of desperation.
Well, that was what they were trying to hit you guys on for the Scottish elections that happened at the same time at Makerfield. And the response was just, we didn't have a branch there. We weren't going to parachute a candidate in or...
Yeah. We can't run two by-elections at the same time. Just not doable.
Yeah. Just not yet. Anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, well, anyway, gentlemen, thank you so much for joining me. And I wonder what the response to this will be.
Indeed.